It's time to play like a Jet
with your host, Scott Mason.
Play like a Jet. What does that mean?
Drops the throw, steps up, floats a bomb up the right seam, looking for Anderson. He's got it. They're not going to catch him. He's going to go the distance. Touchdown. Sam Darnold dials it up to Robbie Anderson. 92 yards.
Anderson, too much deflected.
Bell into the middle of that line, and it's a touchdown.
Big return for Crowder, 85 yards.
Pass thrown, there was contact with the quarterback, and it's incomplete. They got pressure on Prescott. It was Adams who came blitzing in.
Hill hit immediately when he got the handoff.
You know that's
the Q-inator.
Oh my gosh.
Listen, thank you.
From the TOJ Digital Studios, courtesy of The Athletic, a subscription-based sports news site for real fans. It's a great mix of national voices that you already know, like Jay Glazer, Mike Sandel, Mike Lombardi, the late, great Don Banks, wrote for The Athletic, too, and awesome local writers. In fact, one of my buddies, Harif Hassan, covers the Vikings, and I was just reading an awesome article that he wrote about this critical offseason for the Vikings. So if you're somebody that likes coverage of your own team, great, plenty of that. But if you're somebody that likes coverage of other teams like I do, you can get tons of great writers that cover teams besides your own. And as I said, great national writers too. And here's the best part. Not only do you get first-rate reporting, but you get all kinds of great analysis, advanced analytics, in-depth player profiles, and more. And it's completely ad-free. No clickbait, just great content. Pro sports, college sports, The Athletic has it all. So if you're not subscribing yet, you're really missing out. Want to get in on the action? I got a great deal for you. Just for being a Play Like a Jet listener, you can go to theathletic.com/overtime, all lowercase letters, and you'll get yourself 40% off a year subscription. 40%, that's a lot. Go to theathletic.com/overtime, all lowercase letters, and get all of this fantastic sports coverage in The Athletic for 40% off today. This is Play Like a Jet. My name is Scott Mason. You can follow me on Twitter at PlayLikeAJet1. And it's a real treat to have my next guest on because for those of us that were around in the old days before you had every piece of information you could ever want at your fingertips on your phone with the internet and everything, we all had to wait for the newspaper to come out the next day to really get the buzz of what was going on around our favorite football team. Now, in the 80s, WFAN emerged, so we had that. And if it was a real major national story, you might get something on ESPN. But the daily newspapers were a big deal. Rich Simini in the New York Daily News, Dave Hutchinson in the Newark Star Ledger, and my next guest, who now writes for NewYorkJets.com, but for a long time was the beat reporter for the New York Jets at the Bergen Record. And I got to tell you, every time I was in New Jersey, I would make sure that I would find somewhere where I could get a copy of the Bergen Record and the Star Ledger because I didn't get an opportunity to read those on a regular basis where I grew up. And so anytime I was out there, I would try and get a hold of that stuff so I could read Hutch and my guest right now, who is Randy Lang, who right now works for NewYorkJets.com. Randy, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. It's awesome to finally have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. I appreciate it. Nice to hear that you remembered me from the old days when we only dealt in print and we didn't do anything electronically or online or anything like that. It's a brand new world out there for sure, and we're all trying to adapt to it. And so, I've got my thing going on with the Jets still, and I tweet away, and got a Facebook account where I keep track of things. But I still am a big fan of print, and I'm glad you remember when I used to write only in print.
Yeah, absolutely. I used to love to read you guys because back then, like I said, everything that you could find out was through the beat. Because, yeah, you might get a little tidbit here and there in the big magazines like SI or Pro Football Weekly or something. And, yeah, you might get a little bit on ESPN if there was a major story. But if we really wanted to know the nooks and crannies of what was going on with the Jets, we had to rely on the beat. And you guys did such a fantastic job of covering the beat. What has that transition been like for you going from doing the daily newspaper thing to now doing digital and also obviously going from working for a media outlet to covering the team for the team?
Well, yeah, it definitely was a transition. In 2007, I made the break from newspapers. We were starting to do a little bit of blogging and some audio, some kind of podcast-like things at the Record when I was close to leaving. But the Record and a lot of newspapers were really kind of behind the curve as it was being revealed to us as the landscape changed for all reporters. So, you know, it was kind of, all right, we're getting used to it now, but meanwhile, everybody else is doing all these other crazy things, and they're blogging every day, and, you know, they're putting their stuff up, and there's no editors involved, and, you know, they would do audio and video on top of it, and, you know, the Record was very slow to adapt to that. Now, of course, they're along with the, for the ride with everybody else. But, you know, I went to the Jets, and that was one of the things that they wanted me for, was to be an editor-in-chief. So I was still doing print, and I was still responsible for the yearbook, which I do still to this day. And then we had a game program that we put out before every home game, for every home game, which we didn't no longer do. So that was the print end of things. But then also there was a blog that they wanted me to do. They called it, you know, I forget what we called it. you know, we had me blogging every day. Eric Allen, my good partner still to this day, was blogging away. And we had interns come in who loved the Jets and got a taste of what it was like to report on the Jets. And, you know, we went from there, but we quickly branched out into Twitter. I remember in 2009, really, I think I tell this story a lot. The Jets at that time had a Twitter account. It did not have 750,000 followers or 750 followers. It had 75 followers.
Wow.
And it was like, what are we going to do with this thing? Everybody seems to be doing this, you know, the Twitter thing. And so Eric Allen and I both said, all right, well, Rex Ryan's here. We're starting, you know, the off-season program. They're out there at minicamp. Why don't we go out and tweet about it? And I had some similar experiences when I worked for the other side, the dark side, the Giants, when I was covering them for the Giants Newsweekly. And we didn't have Twitter at that time, but I was doing a Twitter-like summary of, let's say, training camp or mini camp, where you'd have a lot of, you know, three dot items, just observations, quick observations of what's going on the field and who looks good and who looks bad and what are they doing. And we adapted that to the new format, you know, where it's now instantaneous and it goes to everybody around the world. And we started to grow that, that Twitter follower base. I can't take credit for the 1,200,000 or so that the account has now, because the team quickly realized, well, we got to branch out here. We got to have a Jets Twitter account, and then Eric will have his account, and Randy will have his account. So we all kind of split up and did our things independently, and then we'd rejoin the group when that was appropriate. But, you know, that was the start of it for us, was 2009 or so, and you know, in the last almost 10 years, a little bit more, look at where the thing has gone and where it's going. It's just phenomenal to realize that we're on this roller coaster ride and it has not stopped.
And I love the work that you've been doing over at NewYorkJets.com, because one thing that I always get nervous about is if somebody who's one of my favorites for a long time doing something moves over to something else and does a different venture, is the quality going to be the same? But it's been fantastic, and I really think that the work you've done at NewYorkJets.com is just as good, if not better, than anything that you did with the Bergen Record, and this piece on Winston Hill is right up there. Winston Hill finally got into the Hall of Fame, and a lot of us have been calling for this for a while. I think part of the problem with Winston Hill is that he didn't really have a major platform to champion himself. He had passed away, and he played a long time ago, so a lot of people didn't remember him anymore. But what a fantastic player he was. 8 times he was in All-Star games, 4 times he was an AFL All-Star, 4 times an NFL Pro Bowler, one of the best offensive linemen in league history, and also, you could say, one of the best players the Jets have ever had, period. Not only just one of the best offensive linemen they've had. And so he finally gets in. You wrote a great piece about the journey to get him in, and quotes from some of the teammates that he had along the offensive line. So tell me a little bit about what you found when you dug in here on Winston Hill.
Well, you're right about all of that, Scott. I appreciate, you know, you're remembering all that. And we had the same kind of issues. I mean, we had obviously not forgotten about Winston. We knew that he should be elevated. He was in the Ring of Honor in the inaugural class in 2010. And he made all of the All-Jets teams over the years. The four-decades team of, I think it was 2003, and then we just did another fan poll for the greatest of all time, and he made that team. And so, you know, the fans knew all about him, and so did we inside the building. But you're right. I think there was a tendency to forget that this guy, you know, needed to be honored, and it was a very real possibility that he wasn't going to be because, you know, time passes, and he had died, as you mentioned, in 2016, and his greatest years, at least half of his greatest years, were spent in the American Football League. So, you know, there's all of this coming together where you just say, man, he's never going to make it. And fortunately, the NFL did a very good thing in conjunction with the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and they had the centennial celebration this year, 100 years of NFL football, and one of the things that they planned as a part of that celebration this year was to expand the field of senior candidates who they were going to induct. It's normally one or two seniors every year that gets inducted, and that goes on a rotating basis. They went to a one senior, two contributors 1 year, and then two and one the next year. So the pace was very slow to get a lot of the old time guys and even some of the not so old time guys, like in the 60s and 70s, to get them recognition. But the NFL and the Pro Football Hall of Fame said, all right, let's bring in an expanded class this year in conjunction with the centennial celebration. So several weeks ago, we heard that Winston was in the final field. He was a finalist for those 10 spots of senior candidates. And then last week we found out he indeed had made the Hall of Fame, and that was such a wonderful, unexpected, pleasantly surprising development. And we have done our work over the years, but it was not, we didn't feel like maybe it was going to be heard and, Winston would be forgotten, but he was not forgotten. And that is such a great heartwarming thing. And it's because of people like Joe Namath who spoke up for him. And of course, Weeb Eubank is no longer with us, but in his day, he spoke up for him. And, all of the players he went up against, and those are the kinds of things that we are still hoping will win the day for Joe Klecko, as we've talked about. But right now it's Winston Hill's turn, and Winnie, is going into the Hall of Fame, and we've already heard about it. It's official, but we'll hear about it again the night before the Super Bowl this year, when the whole class is announced and the five modern era guys are inducted. That'll be revealed the night of night before the Super Bowl, and then we'll go to the Hall of Fame ceremonies in August, but the seniors won't be fully nominated or enshrined at that event. They will have their own week or several days in September in Canton, where that will be just devoted to the 10 senior candidates to be inducted into this year's Hall of Fame. And so Winston Hill will be very much a part of the landscape in the NFL from now until September, when he is finally, the final steps are made and his memory would then be enshrined in the football shrine in Canton, Ohio.
Randy, there's some awesome stories in this article that you wrote. The two guys that gave the best stories here that were quoted were Randy Rasmussen and John Schmidt, who played on the offensive line with Winston Hill. And John Schmidt was a guest on this podcast. We did a 10-part series on the 1968 season. We went through the whole season bit by bit, and he had some things to say about Winston Hill there. One of them was that he never met a person that had a stronger grip in his entire life. And that makes sense because he had a similar quote to you in this article about the fact that he felt like Winston Hill must have been playing with glue on his hands, right?
Yeah, he did. He made that comment in in his introduction in explaining why he loved Winston and why Winston should be in the Hall. And, you know, I think the quote I'm looking for right now, he says, you know, they were captains back then together, but he said Winston was the spiritual leader of the team. And that on top of the fact that he was, you know, an all-pro offensive tackle, which he was. But, of course, the first 4 years were in the AFL as a member of the AFL All-Star rosters. And then when the leagues merged in 1970, Winston made the transition and he became a Pro Bowler for the last four times in the merged leagues, which, you know, it's kind of validated the you know, the honors that he received in the AFL. But as Schmitty said, you know, it was like he had glue on his hands. He was a great teammate and a great guy. And, you know, the one thing that a lot of people mentioned to me when I wrote this story, and I also have another story that will be going up soon on Winston's immediate family and how they're celebrating his induction and his memory. So that has yet to be, you know, yet to go up on NewYorkJets.com, but that's coming. But everybody kind of said the same thing. You know, it took a long time to get here, but we're glad it did, and it needed to happen, and it's great that it did happen for such a fantastic guy.
I wanted to bring up what Randy Rasmussen talked about with Winston Hill as well. There were two stories in your piece that really caught my eye. One of them was a story about how Winston Hill took Randy Rasmussen under his wing when Randy was a rookie and taught him how to pass block at the NFL level. The other was a more amusing anecdote to me about the fact that Winston Hill would show up early every year at training camp to see who the competition was. And I say it was amusing to me because who was going to be competition for Winston Hill at that point? But I think it tells you a lot about what a great player he was, what a great leader he was, and what a great person he was, right?
Absolutely. You know, the Rasmussen story was basically Winston was telling Randy how to hold, which was funny. But, you know, he went to Rasmussen after a practice and he said, "Randy, I notice you're having a little trouble pass blocking." And Randy said, "Yeah, I'm having a little bit of trouble." This was Randy's rookie year back in, I think it was 1965. And, you know, Winston said, "All right, here, grab my shoulder pads." And he meant right down around the breastplate on the side where the pads come down and you lace them together. And he says, "Now I want you to lift it and pull up as hard as you can." And lo and behold, the shoulder pads went up around his chin. And Winston told him, he says, "You know, now you see, Randy, I can't do anything." And Randy says, "Well, you know, Winston, that's holding." And he says, Winston smacked him as hard as he could. And said, "All right, let's do it again." You know, he kind of went into drill sergeant mode on him. And so Rasmussen got the hang of this thing. And Winston's line to him was, you know, that's now you're pass blocking in the American Football League. You're doing it the AFL way. Now, I don't think every block was holding. And certainly that was, you know, something that, you know, you did as a last resort. But you also had to use every trick in the book, especially in the AFL in those days, to survive, because it was a you know, a tough game. And and of course they were also, I think ultimately their goal was to merge with the NFL, which they did finally, but it took a decade to get together in 1970. So there was a lot of, you know, there's a lot of urgency going on to play well, and of course when you went to the Super Bowl, to do well in the Super Bowl. And that didn't happen the first two games when the Packers, as we all remember, you know, took care of the Raiders and the Chiefs. But then came the Jets and the Colts in Super Bowl III, January 12, 1969, in the Orange Bowl. And Winston Hill was the left tackle protecting Joe Namath's flanks, his blind side especially. And also, he was one of the lead blockers on 19 straight, that great play that the Jets had inscribed on the inside of their Super Bowl rings. The name of the play, 19 straight, which led to so many great runs by Emerson Boozer, but by Matt Snell. And they would run it off left side, and Emerson would get out in front, and Randy Rasmussen would be left guard. He'd be out pulling wide, and there's Winston Hill leading the way. And the only touchdown that the Jets scored in Super Bowl III was run off of 19 straight with Winston Hill blocking and leading the way for Matt Snell. So, you know, those are, you know, some of the great memories, you know, that, you know, I wasn't at that game. I was a little too young for that, but I did remember watching it on TV, and I watched that play over many times. And, you know, the artistry and the precision that they ran it was great. And it was, you know, all or a lot of it was because of Winston Hill's contributions. Joan Namath has said that. And I remember another quote, which I did not use in this piece, but Emerson Boozer said, you know, Winston Hill, he seems like such a nice guy. He's a great man. He's friendly. He's a family man. He was vicious on the field. So it's like, how do you square those two things? Well, that's just because that's what you got to be on the field. And that was Winston Hill. You know, he was a vicious, but a fair player. And, you know, he played by the rules, unless, of course, it got, you know, he had to hold somebody legally. But he was one of the greats in those days. And that's what got him started on the way to many years later, this year, being admitted to the Hall of Fame.
Incredible strength and agility. A lot of people don't know that Winston Hill was actually a world-class tennis player before he got so entrenched in football. So he had that tremendous footwork and agility that you get from playing tennis. Just an all-around terrific offensive tackle. The Jets would be lucky to have anybody half as good as him on the roster in 2020 and beyond. I also thought it was amazing to read back and remember how tough Winston Hill was, because Randy, you chronicled in here, and I had forgotten about some of this stuff, how in the 1965 preseason, he played through a broken leg, and then somebody stepped on his throat in 1974, and he kept playing after that. So there was really nothing this guy couldn't do.
Well, yeah, and that was another part of his game, was not just that he was a technician and that he was you know, tough and mean, and he got the job done, but he also was indestructible. He had 195 consecutive games played with the Jets, and 174 of them were starts. And those are both records, are still to this day records for the Jets offensive linemen. And only a few players have exceeded the games played. I think Randy Rasmussen got ahead of him finally, when right before he retired, and Pat Leahy, I'm pretty sure, played in that many games. But you know, that's an incredible run for anybody. And you know, Winston just never came out of the game, even when, as you mentioned, he had a broken leg, and that was in the preseason. So I think he might have missed a preseason game, but he never missed any regular season games because of that. Or, you know, when he got stepped on, probably couldn't speak for a few weeks because his throat was crushed, but he kept on playing because that was the way he was. And that's the way it was in those days, and still is to this day to a certain extent. But they don't make him quite like Winston Hill anymore. And that's why I think the NFL and the Hall of Fame finally came around to saying, you know, it's time to admit number 75 into the hallowed shrine.
It's about time, and hopefully Joe Klecko is next. And not that I want to compare anybody to Joe Klecko. I'm certainly not doing that. But the Jets got another nice surprise on the defensive line this year, one of Klecko's old spots in Foley Fatakasi. And Randy, you wrote a nice little profile about Foley over at NewYorkJets.com. Very surprising season for him after last year. A lot of people had written him off, sixth-round pick out of UConn. But he had a really impactful season, especially in the run game.
Yeah, he did, Scott. He was he came on, and I think that was a pleasant surprise, too, for this year's team. He was not alone. I think Jet fans who appreciate great run defense got a lot of it this year. The Jets were number two in the NFL in yards allowed per game, rushing yards allowed per game, and also rushing yards allowed per carry. And, you know, I mean, they weren't perfect. I mean, there were a few games. I think Leonard Fournette had a big run against them, but then after he had that big run, they shut him down in game seven against Jacksonville. And, you know, they had a very good, outstanding run defense, and Foley Fatakasi was a part of that. And he became, I mean, after his rookie year, I think he played three plays the entire season. It was probably late in the season, and he just was not used. He was not ready, and the previous regime, Todd Bowles' regime, didn't use him, but he was, you know, he stayed around. He's a very conscientious guy, and he wants to do better. You know, he'll watch anybody and listen to anybody to help him do better. And lo and behold, he was better. And he played, he was not, you know, in the starting lineup, but he was a member of the 5 or 6 man rotation that they had going the whole year. And he was making plays. I think I had him for 7 tackles for loss or no gain, which was, I think, about 5th on the team. But he did not play the 5th most snaps on defense. He was down around 10 or so. I think he had like 325, if I remember, snaps on defense. So, I mean, he was a regular contributor, but not one of the guys you see out there all the time. But when he was out there, he was making plays. He was in the backfield. He smacked down a pass in one game. He got his first pro sack. So he was visible. And, you know, you add him to the equation with Quinnen Williams, and you know, we had Kyle you know, Phillips was just phenomenal as a rookie free agent, you know, out of Tennessee, and he had a very fine season. So you add Foley to that, and you know, we had Nate Shepard, you know, throw him in there, and of course the veterans McClendon and you know, Henry Anderson. You know, it was a very good unit, and if there was a little more stability behind them. And you know, not to say that the linebackers and the corners especially, you know, didn't do their best, but those were 2 injury ravaged positions on the defense. But they also did their best in implementing Greg Williams and you know, Adam Gase's next man up philosophy. But if there was a little more stability behind that defensive line, this defense might have been not number 2, but number 1, and might have, you know, been a you know, a little bit you know, more of a factor in preventing the 1-7 start that the Jets had to come back from and did come back from with their 6-2 finish. So, you know, it is what it is, but you know, that does bode well for next year, and it looks like Foley Fatukasi may be a part of that along with these other guys.
And Andre Carter, the Jets defensive line coach, really seems pleased with him.
Yeah, Andre Carter, you know, is a great name on his own, and he came to the Jets and Adam Gase's first staff, and you got to give Carter. I mean, he probably didn't get enough credit because Greg Williams got, you know, the lion's share of you know, the credit for the turnaround on the defense and just how these guys played, even though they were shedding bodies every week. I mean, middle linebacker, inside linebacker, they must have gone through 5 of them. You know, cornerback, there was a different starting combination every week. I had them for 8 different starters at cornerback this season, which was the most by the Jets except for that 1987 strike season. So you had 2 other, you know, guys who never returned as replacement players who got in games 3 to 5 and 6 more during the season. So that was 8. But that's the only other season that rivaled this season in the number of starting corners that the Jets had to put on the field. You don't want to do that if you don't have to, but if you do have to, it's great to have the kind of guys that the Jets had and to have the coaching that they got, you know, from Greg Williams and from Denard Wilson, the DB's coach. And then, of course, you go through the list and all the coaches and, you know, Carter on the defensive line kept things together and kept the rotation going. So, you know, it was a very interesting mix, and Greg Williams gets a lot of credit for it, as he should. But the position coaches had a lot to say about it, too.
Play like a Jet. Play like a Jet.
Depth was a big part of the story of the defense this year because, as you said, they were finding guys that people had never heard of to come in and play well. You talked about Kyle Phillips, the undrafted free agent. He played very well. Another guy that did and helped stop the run in a big way is James Burgess, who you profiled as well. He's going to be a restricted free agent in March. It sounds like he wants to be here. He really enjoyed his role with the Jets this year and playing for Greg Williams, or at least it sure feels that way based on the article that you wrote at NewYorkJets.com.
Yeah, I got that impression too. And, you know, James Burgess, you know, if he had been playing from opening day, who knows what the season might have looked like. He only came in, I think, after 6 games where he was on the preseason roster. He was cut. He was brought back and went on the practice squad for the first 5 weeks of the season, 6 weeks, and didn't really play until, you know, maybe I think it was the Jacksonville game in week 7. And all of a sudden you see this guy flashing all over the field, making tackles and you know, playing behind the line especially. And, you know, even spotting Kyle Phillips that those six games, before he got to play, he finally caught Kyle because Kyle was the hands-down leader in tackles behind the line up until Burgess caught him and then passed him the last 2 weeks of the season. So, you know, that's a good sign. And Burgess says he's very happy to be here. He never got the chance to kind of get this opportunity. Now he has it. He wants to make the most of it. He spoke very highly of Adam Gase's contribution and, of course, G-Dub, you know, too. But I didn't even ask him about Gase, and he was very happy with, what Gase enabled him to do and setting the stage for him on defense. And there are a number of players who have spoken well of the head coach and, of course, the defensive coordinator. That's one reason. If we can segue, I think there's that, you know, the fan unrest out there regarding Adam Gase. It's out there, and it obviously the season didn't start well, but there are a lot of players on this team that still believe in him, believe in the foundation that he wanted to lay down and did lay down. And so, you know, you don't know for sure if 6-2 over the last 8 games is an indication of what's ahead. But there is that possibility. And there are a lot of players in that locker room who, you know, were not being asked about Adam Gase and then spoke highly of him as they went out the door after Baggy Day to go back home and get a little rest in and then start the process all over again. So, we'll be hearing about that some more. But, you know, I just thought I'd throw that out there because, you know, the players definitely aren't sharing the same, the same talk that the fan base may be sharing. And I don't think it's unanimous in the fan base, but there are a lot of fans who are upset at the way things started. Not big fans of the new head coach. But, he's getting another year. He should get another year. And, we're going to see what happens if – he and the rest of the Jets, the trainers, the strength coaches and all the, players, the doctors and so on can get this injury thing under control. It's very hard to do. Football, as Rex Ryan always used to say, is 100% injury sport. But if Adam Gase and his people can figure this thing out, there's a really good chance that the 6-2 part of the season won't come in the second half. It'll come in the first half of a playoff run. So, I'm optimistic, but, there is that feeling that the players did enjoy playing for the guy. And, we'll see if that carries through to 2020.
Randy, you're much more optimistic than I think the fan base is based on what's gone down the last 10 years. It's been a rough ride, but I'm hoping that you're 100% right because I really want to see this team get into the playoffs for the first time since January of 2011. We'll see what Joe Douglas is able to do in the offseason, but one position that they definitely have to think about is the kicker position. A lot of people are looking to move on from Sam Ficken, but I don't know. Based on your article, it looks like he may have been a little more valuable than some people think. What did you find when you took a deep dive into what Sam Ficken did for the Jets in 2019?
Yeah, Sam was an interesting case because, obviously the Jets struggled to, find the replacement for Jason Myers, who, in my opinion, maybe they shouldn't have let him get away, but they did. He went to Seattle, did all right, and got in the playoffs. So, the Jets went through several kickers before they got to Ficken in game two. And he wasn't perfect, and that's obvious by, you look at his numbers. His biggest struggle seemed to be, from 45 yards out, maybe 48 yards out. But that doesn't matter. I mean, you're a pro kicker. You got to hit those kicks, or at least a good percentage of them. So those things, were against him. But, he has something about him that, you just say, all right, well, if I could see definitely bringing in competition, which they did. They signed Brett Maher, the former Cowboys kicker, as a, reserve future signee in January, earlier this month. So he's going to have competition. If he beats out the competition, then so be it. If he doesn't, then we'll move on to the next kicker. I like Sam's attitude. And as he says, listen, he knows he didn't make all the kicks that he needed to. He had some that he wanted back, but he feels like he never, missed a kick that he had to make. And you say, well, all right, maybe that's true. I mean, He did beat Miami with a last second kick, a walk off field goal. And, you know, he did well against the Steelers that he when he needed to give the Jets the cushion, you know, to beat a team that wanted desperately to get to the playoffs and didn't do it. And, you know, I mean, you can point to the games he missed those kicks that he should have made. And you can point to the ones where, hey, you know, all right, he might have something going there. I don't know. That's what this game is all about, finding, you know, you don't have a large database to choose from if you're a coach or a scout. You just have those 16 games and practices, and you try to extrapolate from practices to games, and then you see what he can do in the games and limited opportunities. And, you know, I want to believe in Sam Ficken, and yet I think it's certainly appropriate to bring in competition. So let's do it, and let's have a kicking competition. But, you know, I'm not ready to, you know, say goodbye, Sam. I want to see who they bring in to beat him out.
Play like a Jet. Play like a Jet.
Randy, last bit of business. I wanted to talk to you about this Quick Hits article that you wrote that has a bunch of little factoids that I thought were really interesting. So I figured we would go through them one by one, and then you can just tell me a little bit about each one. You had some fun facts about Jamal Adams, for starters. Now, we know what happened with him earlier in the season. There was some turmoil. It looked like there might come a time where he was going to get traded, if not by the trade deadline, then at the end of the season. Now I'm not so sure. It looks like we may be back where we were before, where he's Mr. Jet again, and perhaps Joe Douglas works to try and get him signed to an extension this offseason. That remains to be seen. But you had some interesting stuff about Jamal Adams in your article that involves Jet history and also NFL history. Some really eye-opening numbers.
Yeah, I mean, Jamal had that run. I forget where the games were. It was like game 8 to 10 or something like that. Washington was definitely a part of it, where he racked up 6.5 sacks in 3 games. And, you know, I mean, if you follow the NFL, you know that defensive backs do not do that. I mean, even the guys you send every once in a while from, you know, safeties in the box, or maybe you blitz them off the corner, I mean, they're not going to get that many sacks in a season. He had it in a 3 or 4 game span. That broke the Jets' record for DBs for sacks in a season, which I believe Kerry Rhodes was the one player to have 5 sacks back in the early 2000s. And so, you know, Jamal broke that record. He was trying to get the NFL record, which Adrian Wilson, I believe, was the guy for the Arizona Cardinals who did it in 2008, if I remember correctly, where he had 8 sacks in the regular season that year. And Jamal said, oh, I'm definitely going to break it, you know, no ifs, ands, or buts. Well, he didn't get there. But the one thing I did research, you know, you have to package a few stats together to get here, but and it's not a record as such. It's more like a distinction. The NFL, you know, Elias Sports Bureau does not do this as a record in its NFL record books, but it's still darned interesting that Adams became the first defensive back, basically in NFL history, going back to 1981, which is when the league started recording sacks on an individual basis. He's the first DB to have 6-plus sacks and 2-plus touchdown returns in a season since 1981. And then, you know, I went further and just said, well, is he? Who else has done that at any position? And he was the first to do it in the last, what, 5 seasons. 2014 was the last time anybody at linebacker, basically, was able to duplicate that 6-plus sacks and 2-plus return TDs in a season. So, you know, Jamal did kind of make NFL history, and, you know, he didn't set the record he wanted to, but, you know, he did make his second Pro Bowl. He's going to make his second start, if I'm not mistaken. He probably will try to win his second, you know, Defensive Player of the Game award. And all of that will be a prelude to, you know, how he looks as he starts the next offseason, and what the Jets will do regarding trying to nail him down for the long term. I don't have any information on that. They don't talk to me about, you know, what they're doing contract-wise until it happens. But, you know, Joe Douglas at the end of the season had nothing but great things to say about Jamal Adams. You know, he didn't back off on his, you know, view that, hey, listen, if somebody calls me, I'm going to talk to them. I think there's an understanding between Jamal and Joe Douglas and the team that, you know, they're happy together, and let's see if we can keep together. That would be great.
Everybody was psyched up about Jamal Adams at the end of the season, but some people were disappointed in the performance of Le'Veon Bell. But you found some numbers that really put that performance in perspective and give fans much more of a reason to be optimistic going into 2020.
Yeah, Le'Veon was an interesting case. I mean, I think there was a lot of optimism early on that, all right, we got Le'Veon Bell. I mean, this is great. It did not go the way that Le'Veon or the Jets offense or the line or Sam Darnold or Adam Gase wanted it to go. He had a very low, I think it was 3.2 yards per carry, lowest of his career. His yardage was his lowest. But, you know, you had to dig kind of into the weeds to see what was happening. I didn't find any back in Jets history. I'm thinking, I charted it up and said, and I keep my own yards after first contact numbers. And it's like 2.19 yards after first contact. And, that was compared to 1.03 yards before first contact. The before first contact is very low. You're usually talking about, running backs are getting 2 yards before first contact, 2 after, they're 4 yards per carry guy. Le'Veon at 1.03, very low, but the 2.19 figure after first contact, was very high. And, it was, in fact, the percentage of after contact, the first contact, was the second highest among all the Jets running backs with 100 carries since 2013. The only one higher was Chris Ivory back in 13. He had 70% of his yards after first contact, and Le'Veon had 68% of his yardage. So what does that say? I mean, that's a lot of mumbo-jumbo maybe, but, you try to, bring some meaning to these kinds of numbers is why you keep them. And, my view was Le'Veon was getting hit a lot at and behind the line of scrimmage. The Jets offensive line, similar to the cornerbacks and the linebackers, an injury ravaged group. They did their best, but every week it seemed, or towards the end of the season was almost every week, they had a new starter in, and they were trying to do the best they could for Le'Veon, but everyone knows Le'Veon's rushing style with the Steelers, and he had a veteran offensive line who knew how to block for him and how to sustain blocks for him and give him a chance to use his patient running style before he burst through the openings and did the damage that he did there. And that wasn't happening early on. And it's, what can you say? I mean, the Jets had an offensive line that was battered and bruised and was having a little trouble meshing. And Le'Veon was one of the players who struggled because of that. But as the season went on, he got a little more traction, and the offensive line got a little more traction for him. And he finally hit a little bit of an uptick. It wasn't a great uptick. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. But, his second half, his last third of games was better than his first two-thirds. And so, you say, it seems like, they could trade him, I guess, if they wanted to, but he's under contract, and, why don't we see if we can make this thing work and get a better offensive line to protect Sam Darnold and to block for Le'Veon Bell. So we'll see how that shakes out in the offseason. But I think that there was, it was a little hard to tell, but I think there definitely was some progress in the last half, the last third of the season for Le'Veon Bell, and there's promise for him to return to the form that he had in his 5 seasons with the Steelers.
The hope is that Le'Veon Bell can be a major weapon for Sam Darnold in 2020. The way that the tight ends have been for Sam Darnold, first in his rookie year in 2018 with the emergence of Christopher Herndon, and then in 2019 with the emergence of Ryan Griffin after Herndon first was suspended and then got injured. You had some interesting tidbits about the Jets in the tight end position.
Well, yeah, it's when you looked at it, you figured, well, this is Chris Herndon's group, and he's going to have a great campaign as soon as he comes back from his suspension. So it took him 6 games to do that, and he got back, and then he got hurt in the 1 game back, and he was gone. So it wasn't Chris Herndon's group. And so you had to say, what's going to happen at this position? Well, Ryan Griffin happened at the position, and that was a very positive development. And kudos to the Jets, you know, for uncovering him and bringing him into the fold. And even though he ended the year on IR, like a lot of players did, he did enough that up until the last three or four games, I think he got hurt in the 13th game. You know, he signed an extension to stay with the team. And one reason that's a good idea was because of the numbers that I came up with. I like to keep track of not just what everybody else does with quarterbacks, which is the passer rating, but I like to apply the passer rating categories. There's four of them. There's completion percentage, yards per attempt, interception rate, touchdown rate. And you can apply those four things to not only quarterbacks, but to receivers. And so I did that, and I do that every year and just to see what happens. And lo and behold, the tight end position as a group had its best year in a long time since, I think I said 2000, as far as the receiver rating goes. And that's the passer rating, but only as it applies to the receivers and the balls they caught, as opposed to the balls that the quarterback threw. And so you know what a good passer rating is. It's over 100. It's 110. It's 120. I had the tight ends as a group compiling a 122.0 receiver rating, you know, for the season. And primarily that was Ryan Griffin doing his thing. But, you know, you had, you know, Daniel Brown had contributed a little bit there. And I think he had two touchdown passes and did a little work there. And if Chris Herndon can rejoin that group, and Trayvon Wesco got a little work, he had a little bit of prominence in the offense. You would hope to see that increase. This tight end group can be a definite, you know, it's not going to be, well, let's let them block and maybe we'll throw them the ball once in a while. It can become a very big part of the passing offense. Sam Darnold definitely liked finding Ryan Griffin in the formation. And last year he loved finding Chris Herndon. So, this is all, you know, I mean, the reason I do these things are to say, listen, Jets fans, it's not, you know, you don't have to be down in the mouth. There's good things ahead. Let's hang in there. You know? So tight end is one of those positions to give us all hope for 2020, not just for Sam Darnold, but for the passing game and the offense in general.
And for special teams, because, Randy, we've talked about what a great job Greg Williams did with the defense, but you can't emphasize enough how great Brant Boyer did with special teams. Lachlan Edwards continued to play really well, and the emergence of Vincent Smith, who the Jets had plucked off the Houston Texans practice squad. Both of those guys were key contributors on special teams. You had some cool tidbits about both of them.
Yeah, well, Vincent, he's a very fast guy. I think I quoted Brant Boyer saying, Vincent is pretty damn fast. Well, that's pretty good praise from the special teams coordinator. And, you know, I did mostly, I think that one note was on his receptions. But he also did a very good job on kickoff returns when he got the ball. And then in particular, we have Lachlan, you know, Edwards, who, you know, I think there's also a feeling among Jet fans, hey, you know, I don't know, maybe it's time to move on. And, you know, he had a few bad punts that I remember. And I mean, all of that is true, but, you know, let's look at the positives, because Lachlan Edwards is a studious guy. I mean, he wants to do well. I think he's a student of his craft, and, you know, it's easy to overlook the fact. I mean, he still continues to break franchise records in, I think the gross average he did not break this year, but his net broke his own record, his own franchise record of 40.8 last year. His net average this past season was 41.6. He is doing good work with his coverage teams, and that, of course, is also a reflection on Brant Boyer and the Jets' coverage teams. But, you know, Lachlan Edwards is still, you know, finding his way. I mean, he's, you know, we all know his story, came from Australia and Sam Houston State, and, you know, made it to the Jets and kind of hung in there, and every year does a little bit better. And then sometimes, you know, you get a little impatient waiting for him, but I still think he's definitely someone. Again, if you want to bring in competition, that's fine. I think that's a good idea, But, you know, let's see if Lachlan can win the job again, because he's done a number of, you know, great things, especially the one thing I think you were pointing to was his ratio inside the 20 kicks to touchbacks, which is, you know, 9.3. I'm trying to think of, 9.3%. You know, it's a ratio. His ratio of inside 20 to touchbacks was 9 to 1, basically. He only had 3 touchbacks the entire season, Lachlan Edwards. That's outstanding in the NFL. That's not just outstanding in Jets history, but in the NFL. So all of these things tend to make me believe that Lachlan Edwards, you know, is probably, you know, I mean, he's the odds-on favorite. The Jets are not cutting him. But I think they definitely will look to bring in some competition, as they should, for him and for kicker. And, you know, let's see if we can improve the position. And if not, let's make these guys as good as they can be.
We got one Jet great headed to the Hall of Fame, and it's a fairly safe bet that at least one other is going to follow him there someday, but not quite as safe as the protection that you'll get in your home with SimpliSafe. If there's a break-in, SimpliSafe uses real video evidence to give police an eyewitness account of the crime, and that means police dispatch up to 350% faster than for a normal burglar alarm. Outdoor cameras and doorbells alert you when anyone's approaching your home. Entry motion and glass break sensors guard the inside. And SimpliSafe protects your home from fires, water damage, and carbon monoxide poisoning with 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week monitoring by live security professionals. Protect your home with SimpliSafe. Go to simplisafe.com/overtime today and get free shipping on your order, plus a 60-day money-back guarantee. That's simplisafe.com/overtime to save on home security today. simplisafe.com/overtime. So, Randy, to sum things up, Winston Hill headed to the Hall of Fame. Some of these guys on the Jets, like Jamal Adams, may follow him one day. I don't know if that's necessarily the path for Vincent Smith and Lachlan Edwards, but still emerging presence on the special team. So some things to look forward to in 2020, and I'm really glad that we were able to talk about them with Randy Lang, who's covering the Jets for NewYorkJets.com, but for many years was covering the Jets on the Jets beat over at the Bergen Record, a legend of the Jets beat. Randy, thanks so much for coming on. Really appreciate it. I hope you'll come back soon. In the meantime, for anybody that wants to follow you on social media, check out your work. How can they get a hold of you? How can they read your work?
Well, let's see. Twitter is at @RLangJets, and the Jets are still at NYJets, and Eric Allen, I'll throw him in too, at @EAllenJets. So, you know, we love to have you participate with us on Twitter, and you know, you can always reach us, you know, DM us or whatever you wish to do. I don't do as much on Facebook as far as posting a lot of stuff. We actually used Facebook a lot more a few years ago when we were accepting comments to the website through Facebook, and so I would monitor, you know, moderate comments through Facebook, which we don't do it now. But you know, you could find me on Facebook too, I suppose. So come on and send me anything you want to throw at me, and I'll try to respond to you in a timely fashion. And I really appreciate the time. Thanks for having me on, Scott. Appreciate it.
Pleasure was all mine. Like I said, I hope you'll come back soon. Make sure that you're following Randy on Twitter. Make sure that you're reading his work over at NewYorkJets.com. And for the latest and greatest in New York Jets podcasts, you know where to go. That's Turn on the Jets Digital and Turn on the Jets.com.